supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to this special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. Creativity from the inside out. I'm Larry Roebling. Remember this song from the 70s?
Starry, starry night. Paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul.
I've listened to that Don McLean song about Vincent van Gogh for years, but the meaning seems to broaden as I get older. You know, we all have darkness and great beauty in our souls, and it strikes me that creativity in all art forms begins from the inside out.
But I could have told you, Vincent, this world was never meant for one as beautiful.
Joining Dr. Dan today, Deborah Heiligman, her new book, Vincent and Theo, The Van Gogh Brothers, explores their relationship and Vincent's work. Since we are taping this event in the Philadelphia Museum of Art, where there are several of Van Gogh's paintings, curator Jennifer Thompson gives some historical context. And we talk to contemporary artist Sarah Steele. Today's special was taped with a live audience, and yes, it was during cold and flu season. We'll hear more than coughs and sniffles from our audience later in the show, but first, Dr. Dan and his guests get their own creative juices flowing.
We've got to start a show about creativity by trying to figure out what it is. Sarah, we'll start with you. Can you weigh in on it? What is yours? How would you define your own?
Well, getting up in the morning to begin with is a creative act. I guess in a nutshell, what it is both listening inwardly to whatever is speaking to me at an emotional level or level of curiosity, an intellectual level, and responding to that, and also responding to what is inspiring to me from without.
Jennifer?
I think there's an element of invention and originality that can often be associated with creativity and sort of embarking on new ground. And I think Sarah is onto something when it's also a very personal aspect of creativity and that we're all capable of creating.
This is Deborah. Yeah, I think that creativity and the creative process is still a mystery to me, but one thing I can say is that as a writer, I find my creative juices stimulated by other arts. So by listening to music or by coming to an art museum, I often find when I go to a concert, I start writing down notes of thoughts that I'm having that I don't know why I'm having them at that moment. And the same thing when I'm looking at a beautiful piece of art.
In my humble opinion, you can't want to be like the other kids and be a creative person. There's a quality of outsideness that we have to be comfortable with in order to be creative that enables you to look at the world differently. Apropos of that, Deborah, let's talk about Van Gogh. So the first child born of Doris and Anna Van Gogh was stillborn.
Correct.
His name was
Vincent.
The Vincent we know as the artist was born a year after.
To the day. Yes, sir.
Among other things, that means he was conceived while his parents were probably in the depth of their grief 3 months after that. So he's living with this shadow in the house, in his parents' suffering, the shadow in his heart. Any sense of how that informed his life and his art?
I wondered about that a lot when I was writing the book. Not only was there that sort of specter of the child who wasn't there. But that child was buried in the graveyard right next to the house where they lived because his father was a pastor. And so he would sort of walk over the grave that said Vincent van Gogh. I'm sure there was a certain amount of grief. Probably there was also a certain amount of this is what happens and we're just going to get on with our lives. But I think there was probably also some repression in the house. And I think that as time went on, I think he felt the burden of being the first son upon whom all hopes were placed, as his sister-in-law once said.
Jennifer, is there evidence of this? Can you find evidence of this in his work?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. In terms of thinking about how he, his early childhood, there's a great drive to prove himself as an artist. And that really kicks in fairly late because he doesn't become an artist until age 24, he decides this is what he wants to pursue. And then he seems to be incredibly motivated to find his own name and to find his own style. And that even when you look at many of his peers and other artists at that moment, his interest in forging new ground is so strong. And perhaps that has he's determined to prove himself to his parents or to his family, who probably didn't want their eldest son to become an artist.
Or perhaps even to find himself, as we see with other artists. Deborah, you said that many people describe him as a young boy now. Mm-hmm. Temperamental, stubborn, opinionated. In psychological parlance, we call kids like that pain in the butt, you know? But we know that his temperament had to have affected his life and his relationships, yes?
Yes. He had a, like most people, complex temperament. I think he was definitely stubborn and opinionated. One of the great discoveries I made researching the book was that he also had a huge heart. And he just went out of his way to help people, help poor people, help friends.
Jennifer, tell us about his early work and what we're seeing. Do we know anything about what he produced, if he produced, before he was 23?
We actually know very little. I mean, it's almost like he had this sort of life-changing moment, and he really embarks on becoming an artist, which is it's quite distinctive when you think about other artists. You know, I think I work quite a bit with Rodin or Renoir, and they're known as young children to have been drawing on floors and walls and all over their houses, and we don't get quite those same stories from Van Gogh. And Van Gogh, of course, comes to being a painter from being an art dealer, so he has a tremendous knowledge of the art world. And while many of us might have been daunted by that, that doesn't seem to have prevented him from trying to make his own name in that very challenging world.
What can we tell about him just through his early art?
He's very good at painting very simple things of life and the people, you know, very sort of unpreposing, you know, workers around him. And so he's obviously looking very closely and is not... he's not creating imaginary scenes in that sense, or, you know, thinking about historical or religious paintings.
In case you're just joining us, we're taping in the Philadelphia Museum of Art, a perfect place to talk about creativity and life from the inside out. Joining me are some creative guests, author Deborah Heiligman, Jennifer Thompson, curator at the museum, and artist and activist Sarah Steele. I went to talk with you, Deborah, about Vincent's brother, Theo, who certainly caught your interest. Theo's the younger brother.
Yes.
And I know he had his own bouts of depression.
Right. Of course, we don't know that much about Theo because he didn't grow up to be famous. And even when Vincent was famous and people came around to the town where they grew up, they would ask questions about Theo, and there really wasn't much to say. Growing up, he was just the good boy. Vincent was doing his stuff, wandering, you know, around and collecting things and throwing temper tantrums and being brilliant. And Theo was just very quiet and being a good boy, not quite as good a student as Vincent, not as obviously brilliant as Vincent, but when it came time to get a job, he followed in his brother's footsteps and became an art dealer, and he did very well at it. And he was very good with the clients, he was very good with the bookkeeping, he was very good at everything. And so the parents sort of, there were more children, but let's just talk about these older boys, and one who's difficult and one who's easy, they seem to kind of start putting their hopes in Theo rather than in Vincent. The thing is that Vincent and Theo were very, very close to each other and got close, especially once Vincent was out of the house and on this particular visit when Theo came to visit him, and they became friends rather than just brothers. And that was the beginning of their lifelong correspondence and very, very close friendship. But so much throughout their lives together, which weren't very long, Theo was holding Vincent up, but in many ways, Vincent was holding Theo up too.
I wonder, as you describe Theo, that when a child is born to parents who suffer, then they make it their business to be good and not add to the parent's suffering, oftentimes at their own expense. So I wonder if, in a way, he became Vincent's caretaker as an act of loyalty to his parents.
Very much so. And when Vincent was fighting with his parents, Theo kept trying to step in and keep the peace in the family.
Their relationship was very close. It was loving.
Vincent and Theo's?
Yeah.
It was.
Was there hatred in there too?
I can't time travel, but I spent a lot of time with these two guys, and I don't think there was hatred.
No.
I think there was love. I think there was anger. I think there was frustration. I don't think there was hatred. I think Theo admired Vincent so much and knew him in all of his moods. You know, they lived together for a couple of years, too. And I think Vincent admired Theo very much, and they were different. So they were scratchy at times, I would say. I know, I fall in love with my people. What can I say? But I don't think there was hatred. I don't.
Jennifer.
No, do you?
I mean, I've spent a lot of time reading the letters and certainly looking at the paintings, and I don't see that. There is one episode which always sticks out to me about their relationship, and it's when Van Gogh, or Vincent, is in the asylum at Saint-Rémy, and he's sort of recovering and is slowly kind of building up his confidence and painting again, and he writes to their sister and said, you know, Theo has just sent me some Shakespeare. So he'd been reading King Lear, which, of course, is a very fairly dramatic tale, tragedy. And he said, I get so sort of worked up, I have to go outside and look at a blade of grass, an ear of wheat, to calm myself. And so I always reflect back on what was Theo thinking when he sent his brother these Shakespearean tragedies. And he knew his brother was not in a very stable moment. So I think that may speak to a sibling relationship that we're all perhaps familiar with.
I had a patient once tell me that I love my brother dearly, and I even love him when I want to end his life.
There's also a moment in the asylum which moves me, when Vincent was really suffering, but Theo was also suffering. Theo was very physically sick, and he wrote a couple of lines to Vincent, and Vincent could read between the lines. And Vincent pulled himself out of his own misery and became that big brother to Theo in a kind of miraculous way.
Let's talk about his death at age 37. Mm-hmm. At the very end, what did his art look like? I'll turn to you, Jennifer.
And he continues to paint right up until the end. So, and there's no hiatus or pause in any respect there. He always pushed himself to do new things. And so I'm a little cautious about reading too much into those final paintings, simply because he was always embarking a little bit on new territory. But I think it was a bit of a surprise. And a surprise to absolutely all of his friends. And he had a number of artistic friends. He was friends with Signac and Gauguin and Renoir and others. And they were all very much taken aback by his death.
He was suffering for a long time from what we can't go back in time and diagnose, but I think was probably bipolar. It's a misconception that he painted while he was in one of his bad states. He did not. He took care of himself or was taken care of, but when he was feeling well, he painted and drew like a lot, you know, just as much as he could, because he knew he couldn't do his art when he was ill. It is my theory, and I found out talking to Jenny earlier that I'm not alone in this theory, and it wasn't my original theory. I read a paper. I think his death has more to do with the fact that he could tell Theo was dying. Theo was suffering from syphilis and cerebral syphilis, and he looked bad. He was very weak. And I think Vincent thought, I can't go on if Theo's not going to be here. And that's my theory about why he killed himself.
You know, I looked up his last painting. I went to the Van Gogh Museum. Well, Google helped me get there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they describe his last painting as wheat fields with crows. And critics have called that his most haunting painting. Now, is that hindsight? Is that backdoor analysis? You're shaking your head yes, Jennifer.
Well, I can think of a number of other haunting pictures in the last few years. There's a wonderful picture of a moth, an emperor's head moth that we had in the museum a couple of years ago for an exhibition. There are other moments I would say were haunting as well, but no, I think in hindsight we do look back on that last work.
And he does say something in a letter to Theo and Joe that he painted something that shows his loneliness. And I think it was that painting, although I think there's some disagreement whether that's really his last painting or not. We don't know for sure. But he was also painting happy paintings then, wasn't he? I think, some with lots of light and beauty.
You're listening to Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, speaking with author Deborah Heiligman and curator Jennifer Thompson. Coming up, artist and activist Sarah Steele reveals how art helped her survive trauma in her life. I'm Larry Roebling, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to this special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, Creativity from the Inside Out. I'm Larry Roebling. Earlier, Dr. Dan and his guests looked at the life and work of Vincent van Gogh. Next, Dr. Dan talks to Sarah Steele, a working artist today, about bringing our emotional selves into the creative process.
I want to read a quote to you from Jonathan Bliss. He's a concert pianist teacher. He's a writer based in New York City. He's talking here about music, but the same applies to art and I think any form of creative endeavor. He says music is all subtext. He says music's mysterious capacity for saying the unsayable comes in part from its inability to say the sayable. He says, for those of us who love it beyond reason, music, art, speaks to our unconscious desires and fears, gives voice to the feelings we don't know how to express, and sometimes don't even know we have. I want to turn to you, Sarah.
I think that's true. I think, well, I know for a fact that, especially in some more difficult periods of my life, I will make work and when I'm looking at it afterwards is when I start to understand both the work and myself. And sometimes it can be a really long time, a long interval between making the work and understanding it.
Give us a sense of that process.
When I was in my early 30s, I started to go into a pretty serious depression that I just could not find my way out of. And so I found my way to a good therapist, And in the process of working with her, really started to dive deeply into my psyche and into some areas of it that I had been afraid to go visit before. And one of the things that I started to put together that was like a puzzle was the fact that there had been a lot of abuse in my family growing up. At one point, my therapist, who, bless her heart, she really understood something powerful about art making. She said, look, at this point, you go into your studio and you make work and you bring the work in and we'll talk about it. And that really opened up worlds to me. You know, I could see things in my work from a distance that I didn't even know I could be making. And I also, during that period, started to go back to work I had made earlier, all the way back to when I was 14, and really developed some interesting insight into what that work meant. And I could never have known it, you know, as a 15-year-old, as a 19-year-old. I never would have had enough insight, enough self-knowledge. So that's one example.
That's art therapy.
No, it was not art therapy. It was definitely not art therapy. It was therapy. I was making the art. And my therapist was kind of drawing out of me what I thought about the work.
Right. Exactly.
And later, many years after that, I was doing an artist in residency at Friends Hospital, and I was working with patients on the inpatient trauma unit. I had a studio on the campus where I worked, and I am not an art therapist, and I did not pretend to be doing art therapy. But what I did was I had an open studio, and any patient from that unit could come over and in a parallel play kind of setting make art with me in the room. And it was quite astonishing to experience doing that with people who were quote-unquote mentally ill, but certainly going through some really difficult passages, because I learned from them. And, you know, we worked together without talking. It was about the art-making process. It was not about therapy.
Back to the original quote, beyond words. I want to talk about your own PTSD. Did the trauma get into your art? How did it get into your art? And how did your art help you get out of it? Because your description just now, Sarah, was about understanding. Mm-hmm. But I want to go further with you into the healing process.
Well, to take the first part of that question, I think when I was younger, I had no idea what I was expressing in my work, and only in hindsight did it make sense to me. I had an exhibit that was a retrospective of 30 years of my work, and going back through my work with the curator, we found a piece that I had done when I was 14 or 15 that I immediately recognized as a suicide note. Now, at the time that I made that drawing, it was a little sepia ink wash, I couldn't have told you that. But it is crystal clear when I look at it now. So I think there's always that expression of emotion that's happening in work that we may not ever know, and we may not understand it for a long time. In terms of healing, that particular process of doing PTSD work through art making, I really made a large body of work during that period of time and got to the end of it. And I knew when I got to the end of it, and I knew that I didn't have, well, you know, when you finish doing your PTSD work and you understand what's happening in your brain, in your body, your reactivity, and you can sort it out and make stories of it through your wonderful hippocampus, everything changes. So I don't suffer from PTSD anymore. You know, I know that I can be reactive in certain ways, but I'm not all bound up in it in a way that I don't understand it. When I got to the end of that period and knew that I had gotten to the end of it.
And we know our research about trauma. Now, we know that these traumatic memories get stored in parts of the brain that are not verbal.
That's right.
So words don't necessarily fix it. You can talk about it, but often we re-traumatize ourselves. We get it through yoga or dance or physical activities or
painting
or music. Jennifer, I want to turn to you. This story is Sarah's story, clearly, but I wonder if we can see with other artists how they've used their art to help themselves through something.
One incident that comes to mind is with a sculptor, Auguste Rodin. His younger sister passed away quite suddenly from smallpox. She'd entered a religious order just a few months earlier, and so he sort of lost her to the religious order, and then she passed away, and he was quite devastated. He was a young man at that point. And he himself entered a religious order, and he thought he might become a sort of a lay brother. But there was a very astute man in this community who realized that the best way for Rodin to sort of work through his sadness and grief at the loss of his sister would be to set him up in a studio. This father, Aymar, asked Rodin to do his portrait, to sculpt a portrait. Maybe Father Aymar knew that Rodin wasn't going to make a very good lay brother, that he was better as a sculptor, and within a couple of months, in fact, Rodin left the community. And unfortunately, Father Aymar he wasn't very happy with the bust that had been produced. He thought Rodin had taken a few too many liberties with some of the hair and some of the other details. But Father Aymar seems to have kind of kept that somewhat to himself. And it's intriguing that at the end of his life, Rodin actually had a bust of Father Aymar in his bedroom. So I think he may have come back to it again and again as a way of kind of reminding himself of the support he'd received and the friendship and that particular moment.
Sarah, I want to talk to you about what I know is an intimate relationship of yours, and that's with your art. And I want to talk about your relationship with your painting from beginning to the end to when it's sold.
Well, it varies a lot with different pieces. Some pieces are very immediate, body-based, emotional. They just sort of fall out onto the paper. There are other pieces that are more intellectual, and I'm working through something that I'm thinking about in the process of making them. I'm attached to different paintings in different ways. I also sometimes really dislike some of my work, and occasionally really like some of it. And one of the things that I've learned over the years is that I am not a good judge of my work, because I have had paintings that I have exhibited that I hate, and someone has invariably come up to the painting in a show and just, I have to have this. So I've gone to a point at this age where I stopped judging the quality of my work. I know the value that it has to me, I know what it says to me, and I know sometimes it can say something to me personally and something completely different to the viewer. And I no longer try to decide what has value. That's for everybody to determine themselves.
How has that maturity affected your art and your life?
You know, there's a certain discipline to art making, and I've read wonderful quotes, especially by composers about this, that you're not necessarily inspired when you go into your studio in the morning. You go in and you work, and you work on what you're working on. You know, I went in this morning, I was working on a piece, I looked at another piece because I work on a number of pieces at once, and I saw this other one out of the corner of my eye, and I thought, oh, I know what I want to do with that one. So I picked it up and started working on it and got absorbed in it. But I wouldn't say that I felt particularly inspired. But I go to work every day. And sometimes magic happens. And not always. But it's sort of like practicing scales on the piano. If I wasn't practicing scales all the time, I wouldn't, you know, my fingers wouldn't be able to play something when some amazing piece of music is in my head and I need to express it. It's the same thing with painting. You know, I'm maintaining my skills by doing it every day. and increasing my skills, I hope. But I no longer have that youthful fantasy that art is all about inspiration. That's over.
So, Sarah, as you're talking, I'm watching Deborah the writer, and I am watching Dan the writer, and we're nodding. It's the same exact process.
Right.
It's work.
Right.
You go to work, and sometimes what you produce during the day
is just awful
crap. Deborah, your book was great, and it was geared to a young audience. Why is that? And I'm also thinking of the great biography, Lust for Life, which was also not geared to a young audience necessarily, but that's their reader.
Well, children are my people, and I was just listening to a podcast on the way here, and this writer said, you know, you're basically the same age your whole life, so what age is that? I think I'm a few ages, and one of them is definitely a teenager. And I thought about writing about Vincent and Theo for adults or for teenagers, and I thought, you know, Vincent was a teenager his whole life. He is just sort of the epitome of teenagehood. And I know that teenagers will really be able to relate to him. That's not to say that adults won't. I think adults can read this book and will read this book. But I feel like he, you know, he's emotional, he's searching, he's creative, he's intense, he's always in love. He's a teenager. And so that's why I did it for that audience.
Perfect. Perfect.
This is Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb and his guest, author Deborah Heiligman, artist and activist Sarah Steele, and museum curator Jennifer Thompson. Coming up next, our audience asks if creativity can be taught, is there a connection between genius and mental illness, and much more. I'm Larry Roebling, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to this Voices in the Family special with Dr. Dan Gottlieb and his guests Deborah Heiligman, Jennifer Thompson, and Sarah Steele. We taped this live event at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and much of the conversation was about Vincent van Gogh and creativity. Contemporary artist Sarah Steele traced the evolution of her art and her emotional life. Now our audience weighs in.
Mental phenomenon called flow, or being in the zone, hyper concentration, so that you lose track of space and time. Have you ever had that experience?
Definitely. Absolutely. Time telescopes. It's one of my favorite things. And it doesn't happen every day.
Deborah? Jennifer? Deborah, you first.
I think I have had that experience. Honestly, not as much as I would like. I seem to be too tied to the outside world and practicalities, but when I find that I have it the most is when I am sleeping or about to be asleep or about to wake up. I once wrote an entire picture book while I was taking a nap. Honestly, I did. So I think I just have to be in a kind of state where I turn off the sort of organizer and the person who has, you know, juggled family and households for so many years. And once I can shut that all out, I can get into a kind of flow. Also, deadlines help.
Jennifer.
Sure. I think certainly when I'm traveling or spending time in galleries and museums, I find that time can just suddenly, you know, you can lose yourself in paintings and in art. And it's also, for me, it's a nice chance to, you know, get away from the desk, get away from everyday sort of. I always turn my phone off when I go into a museum.
I get it in writing, not consistently. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I get behind my desk, and that what comes out from inside of me, you know, akin to what Sarah described, you know, and I'm lost. I'm finding me. I'm listening, and I can almost observe, you know, the part of me that's coming out, and how it's what I know professionally is being filtered through my prefrontal cortex, and I am gone. Time stops. It's a great feeling. Not all that accessible.
I'm a teacher, and I was wondering, can you teach creativity? And if so, how?
I think so, absolutely.
I think you can foster it, for sure, too, because you don't want to put restrictions on people, like the old story, you know, a kid will make a painting and the sky is green,
right,
and the teacher will say, no, no, that's wrong. You know, so I think you can foster a creative atmosphere.
I think it's almost not teaching rather than teaching. Mm. It's sort of stepping outside of it and letting kids do whatever it is that they do, and then encouraging their own curiosity, encouraging their expression, really supporting them in that. I think every single human being is creative. Every single one of us. Mm-hmm.
And I would say the cross, we were talking about before, about the cross-pollination of arts. So put music on it while people are painting or drawing, you know, or writing. I play classical music while I'm writing all the time, and it really helps.
My question is, you spoke to both feelings and experience that can inspire art, so trauma or happiness, anything in between. And I'm just curious, both for you, Sarah, and then from what we've seen in Van Gogh, which feelings have really inspired the most art?
These are hard
questions. I don't know that I could say. I really don't know that I could say. You know, that might be something that has to be decided, you know, once I die and people start look at what's left before it goes in the dumpster, you know.
I know that Vincent, for one thing, I don't know if this would really count, but he was very moved by people who were poor and people who were struggling and people who were having a hard time in life. And his big heart, you know, wanted to capture that and wanted to be able to capture that feeling of striving and suffering and sort of somehow impart that to the world in a beautiful way.
Yeah, actually, I'll revise my answer a little bit. Sometimes art making is one of the most handy ways for me to process a challenging emotion, whether it's anger or grief. But it's a lot more fun to make a painting when I'm in a good mood, too. So, you know.
I would say what, Deborah, you just described about Van Gogh, that emotion clearly is compassion.
Yes.
And through his art, turned that compassion into a wish to help others.
Yes.
What we would call today social activism. And,
yes,
you know, that's what Sarah does.
And you know, I think he would be right next to you, Sarah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't write when I'm miserable or angry. I mean, I can write, but it's not good.
Oh, I can write.
Yeah.
I write about my misery.
And, right.
But not seriously, not in a way to complain about it, but in an effort to describe it. And then I wind up finding out about right. myself, and I can, it generates right. more self-compassion.
Huh. And then eventually, if you want to publish it, then you revise it.
Never.
Oh, okay.
I am curious to hear more thoughts from the panel about connections and correlation between mental illness, or perhaps certain types of mental illness, and extraordinary genius and creativity. Van Gogh is an example. We know anecdotally of other examples in art, science, chess world, mathematics. I don't know whether scientifically there is a correlation, but just we know of many examples. Since you're speaking and reflecting on Van Gogh, what does that say to us, perhaps to the rest of us? What deeper meaning do you see there in the connection?
I'm looking at you, Dan.
I want to be careful here. I understand the question, and I certainly agree with your observation. But the vast majority of people with mental illness are not artists, they're not creative, they suffer, they get up and they go to work, and we're talking about the vast, vast majority. So what is it we're observing? And look, you know, anybody who's going to analyze it is going to analyze it their own way. But I think we're back to what I suggested earlier about being on the outside and knowing you're on the outside, number one. And number two, as a result of that, seeing the world differently. You know, I wanted my first book, I wanted to write a book called Being Human, Observations of a Foreign Correspondent, because that's how I experienced myself, and I would imagine I'm not the only one who has. So I think that's what happens. The other thing is with creative people, with aging people, and with many with various forms of mental illness, there's a part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, that thins out. And that's the part of the brain that worries about what others might think about them, self-consciousness. So that's my thoughts about your question.
So you're saying that my prefrontal cortex has thinned quite a bit.
Yes. Yeah. Reminds me of a line from a Paul Simon song. He says, "Why am I soft in the middle, and the rest of my life is so hard?"
When I was writing the book, can I just say, when I was writing Vincent and Theo, every time I got to a place where Vincent was doing something that was not healthful, right? So he would take these long walks without eating. He was drinking too much coffee, too much alcohol. He was doing basically everything that was wrong without knowing it, of course. And of course, he didn't have any medication because he was living in the 19th century. So I just kept thinking, what if he was on medication and he was getting a good night's sleep and eating well? Can you imagine what he would have produced? I don't think it's the opposite. I think if he had been healthy, it would have been magnificent, even more magnificent, his body of work. And I too shy away from the sort of creativity and madness thing. Maybe I just want to think that I'm sane.
As long as it's got a broad definition.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, we're all under the big hump and the bell curve.
Yeah. Exactly.
So I'm a middle school art teacher and a painter. And there are times when giving to the kids all the time leaves me personally feeling empty creatively. So I've read some things from different books like The Artist's Way and Art and Fear and The Gift. And just wondering if there are any techniques or tips or tricks that any of you use when you're feeling like very emptied out creatively, but you still want to make your own work, but you're just kind of empty.
In the artist way, she has artist states. Mm-hmm. I think they're really useful. Sometimes when I'm in a foul mood and can't do anything productive, including the laundry, I force myself to come down to the museum because I know that there are paintings in this place that cure me of whatever ails me. And I just have to go park myself in front of one of them and sit there for an hour until, you know, I'm mended. So
and also surrounding yourself with other people, I think, who are doing what you're doing, not just children, not just middle schoolers, right? Mm-hmm. And being with people, maybe making, you know, some kind of an artist group. I know I've, over the many years, belonged in writers groups, and I have writer friends, and it's a huge help to have that kind of support and encouragement for what you're doing.
And when you're tired, take a nap.
Yes. Naps are great.
I studied for years to know that.
I am going to ask a question that puts me at risk of sounding like a cranky old lady, but I'm going to embrace her and just allow her to come into the room and let her voice. We've been talking about the creative process and artistry, and when I think about music and dance and art and sculpture and writing, I think about a very tactile, physical body experience. And I wonder what happens to creativity when we now spend 80% of our waking hours typing on a very tiny keyboard held 18 inches from our face. Does that impact our spirit and creative soul?
I'm your cranky sister.
I'm right there with you, honey.
Yeah, I have found that I have to really limit my screen time. And I do take I take tech Sabbaths where I just shut everything down because I know it's not good for me. I know it's not good for my brain.
Yeah. I spend a lot of time at the computer, and a lot of what I do is research because I write so much nonfiction. But I always have a notebook with me, and I wake up first thing in the morning and I write and I read and I try to handwrite as much as possible. And in fact, I was just talking to a friend of mine who's been suffering migraines, and I said, I think it's the computer. She's a writer. It's probably the computer screen. And she said, I think I might have to relearn how to write with pen or pencil and paper. And I think it's not just a physical thing. It's an emotional thing. And it does, you're right, I think, separate us from the world. And so
I think it's also a brain thing.
Brain, definitely.
You know, when I'm writing longhand or reading a book, which I much prefer to reading on screen,
yeah,
something in me is operating differently.
The other thing that we were talking about flow before, and I thought afterwards, when I'm having trouble writing or I'm just feeling too bombarded by all the screen stuff, one of the best things I can do is go for a walk.
Yes.
And I just walk and I have, you know, a notebook with me, or I must admit it, sometimes I do dictate into my phone. It's different. And just that feeling of space and air and live things, you know, it's very...
Actually, Richard Louv writes eloquently about that, creativity in children and being in nature, the necessity of that.
So, recently, a couple of years ago, I had the same anxiety as probably most of the people in the room, so I wanted an expert on the show to validate my anxiety. And the SOB didn't do it. It was never on my show again. But he said, it's a tool. It's a hammer. You can use a hammer to kill somebody. You can use a hammer to build a home. It's a tool, and it's simply about how you use it. That's all. And hopefully, that's our choice. And there is a quality of addiction, and we do need Sabbaths because it's not good for the brain, but it's a tool. And we can choose how we use these tools.
Vincent would probably be all over Facebook, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, it looks like we have run out of time, and I want to thank all of you for coming out. I hope you enjoyed this time as much as I did. I want to thank the three of you. You have just been great. You've just made it a fun evening. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to you.
This has been a Voices in the Family special with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. His guests were Jennifer Thompson, curator at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, artist and activist Sarah Steele, and author Deborah Heiligman, whose latest book is Vincent and Theo, The Van Gogh Brothers. If you'd like to be part of our live audience at our next taping, keep an eye on the WHYY events page for more information. And talk to us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. We'd love to hear from you. The engineers for today's show were Adam Stanishevsky, Joyce Lieberman, and Diana Martinez. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of WHYY Audio Contact. I'm Larry Roebling, writer and producer of Voices in the Family. Dr. Dan Gottlieb is the host.
Have a good week, my friends. And the week after that. And the week after that. And the week after that.